Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Humorist Dave Barry has been making people laugh for a long time. He has an impressive list of very funny, best-selling books. He has a Pulitzer Prize for his columns over some 20 years with the Miami Herald, and has written a series of Peter Pan prequels with his pal Ridley Pearson. That's the Peter and the Starcatchers series for young readers, which went on to inspire a Tony Award-winning Broadway show, and a movie is to come. He has also been a featured member of the rock band The Rock Bottom Remainders with fellow authors. I think it was he who said they play music as well as Metallica writes books. So what does Dave Barry do in his spare time? Well, he keeps writing books and visiting radio stations. His latest book is You Can Date Boys When You're 40. It's subtitled Dave Barry on Parenting and Other Topics He Knows Very Little About. It is a pleasure to see you, sir. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Don.
You know, I have to tell you that the only other author who makes me laugh out loud when I'm reading is
Joyce Carol Oates.
Not
she
quite.
She cracks me up, too.
Yeah, especially the thing on morning. There's nothing like it. Is Robert Benchley.
Oh. Well,
I think I put you in some pretty good company. I bet he inspired you.
You absolutely, yes. He is my idol. When I was maybe 9 or 10 years old, I discovered my dad was a big fan of Robert Benchley and P.G. Woodhouse. But we had all the Benchley collections, and I started reading them, and I just couldn't believe it that a grown-up wrote that, because it was so smart but so silly. And that was what distinguished him, I think, he was just the level of silliness he aspired to for a guy who went to Harvard and was very, literate. And I just loved writing, loved that writing, and that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to write like that.
So I hit the nail on the head.
He was your
inspiration.
So you didn't already know that?
I didn't already know that, no. But I'm a great fan of his, and
so
I'm a great fan of yours.
I still collect his books, and I still read them regularly.
You know, one of the things about him is you can go back, and it's the same for you, as a matter of fact, is you can read them and go back. I mean, for humorists, once you've heard the joke, right, why do you need to hear it again? But you can go back to him, and you can go back to your work as well.
That's because we're old, Don, and we forget. We get what we forget.
Well, let's not get into that part of the Let's leave that off limits. Dave Barry, do you ever feel any particular pressure to be funny all the time? I mean, when you come to a studio like this, just, I've got to be funny.
Not so much. This definitely not, because it's NPR and you actually take the time usually to talk, which is rare. When you're on one of those morning radio shows where you have like 2 minutes, then you feel that pressure. Or especially when you do TV, because first of all, they generally have not read your book. So they don't necessarily even know that it's supposed to be funny. And you have very little time, so you just kind of have to get it across. You mentioned the Rock Bottom Remainders. One of the members of that band is Mitch Albom. Mm-hmm. And we've had many discussions about being interviewed on radio. And Mitch is actually – he's got a radio show. He's a very good interviewer. But
he was on this program, as a matter of fact. He was a great guest.
He told me this story. It was just sort of summed up book tour. When he first started going around with Tuesdays with Maury, which became a huge, gigantic seller. But at the time, nobody had heard of it. And, Mitch was known as a sports writer. So he's on one of those morning FM shows where the guy's got to do the weather. He's got to do the traffic. And, the book gets put in front of him. He's clearly never read it. He doesn't have any idea what it's about. So he finishes up the weather. He goes, my next guest is Mitch Albom. He's got a great new book out. It's called Tuesdays with Maury. So, Mitch, I guess the first question is, why Tuesdays? and then Mitch has a minute and a half to get across the story of his professor who was dying, and he went to, sure. It's kind of like that. With me, it's I got to be funny then, something with that kind of situation.
One author who was a guest in the program says he can always tell when the interviewer has just looked at the table of contents and does the interview directly from that.
The Larry King method of interviewing.
Right. Yeah. God rest his soul. Wherever Larry King is, alive or
I think he's still
well.
Alive.
I know he is. But, in this business, when you're not on,
you're dead.
Yeah. You're as good as dead. Talking about these tours, I have a quote here, and I think it was an interview you did with the Post-Dispatch here. It says, you say, you're supposed to be relentless relentlessly cheerful on these book tours, cheerful about your book. Of course, you hate your book by the 90th interview that you've done about it. And at some point in the process, you want to talk about something else.
Yeah, they're always bringing the book to you, and it's like at some point it becomes this hideous insect you don't want to see anymore. But, you tend to get a lot of the same questions, and you tend to get, and you end up giving sort of a lot of the same answers, and you feel like, did I already say this on the show? It's like Groundhog Day book tour.
Well, if you were to talk about something else, what are the things that you like to talk about that you're never asked?
Well, nothing comes to,
let's talk about the book.
Okay.
What was the inspiration? Let me ask the question that would always be asked. The inspiration for suddenly deciding that you had to write about your family and that you don't date boys until you're 40.
Well, I've always written about my family. I wrote about my son, Rob, he's 33 now. He's a grown-up. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's about to become a dad. Now I write more about my daughter. And people say, does it bother them that you write about them? And I say, if Sophie doesn't want me to write about her, then Sophie can pay for her own college education. but this is what I do. But they're both used to it. And in this case, the title essay of the book is about my daughter growing up. There are a lot of other essays in it, but that's the one they focused on. I had a number of other titles I proposed, including Dave Barry's Vague General Book of Humor Topics. The branding-oriented one was Dave Barry, a Dave Barry book by Dave Barry. Mm-hmm. One that was sort of about family was Without Family, We Would Have Nothing Except Way More Money and Spare Time. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they liked the idea of, because there's a couple of essays in there about parenting, about using a parenting-oriented title. And so the beginning, the inspiration was, and it was a genuine struggle. It's not like I was faking it. I was not ready for having a daughter go through puberty, which we need to find a cure for, Don. I was not ready for that.
I have a daughter.
Okay,
exactly what you're talking about.
And, you become the cliche dad because boys show up. And I didn't – when my son was starting to date and stuff, go ahead, have your fun. I was like, it was totally okay with it. I never worried about it, But boys coming to our house, that I still just have not adjusted to it.
Because
exactly. That's what I say. I am a male. I'm a lifelong male. And we're scum. That's gender. I don't want this gender around my house, with my daughter in it. My wife, of course, doesn't get this. She's much more trusted. She's a woman, so she thinks it's okay to let them in. She has to get in. They get in through the front door, the boys.
A school teacher once told me that the worst creature on planet Earth is an eighth grade girl. And it's because of, and I'm sure I'm offending a great many people by saying this, but what they're going through at that time with the hormones and the cliques and the kind of the things that they do and say about each other and the fact they'll be best pals with somebody one day, arch enemy the next day. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about 13 years old.
My daughter is an eighth grade girl, and it's so true. Like with the boys, they become basically larger and hairier and smellier, but they're still boys. They're still they're so far behind. They're like it's kind of a sad race to watch. And then the girls, meanwhile, become very, very sophisticated and savvy and social. My daughter is best friends with every other 14-year-old girl in North and South America, as far as I can tell. They're all in this giant, vast network, and there's a lot going on in that network. They don't really have time for me. I have very few conversations with my daughter anymore beyond, what kind of cereal do we have? That's the level of conversation.
And then they grow up to be women. And you have a chapter in your book dealing with men and women on the phone, for instance, and how they interact and how different that is. And it is so classic.
Well, my theory about men and women is that men think about maybe a thousandth as much as women do. When women are always complaining, why don't we share our feelings with them? I say, because we don't have that to share. There's not as much going on. Like my wife, who I think fairly typical, she can be apart from one of her friends for, let's say, 3 hours. They can get back together after 3 hours and discuss what happened in the 3 hours for 6 hours.
Right.
They can just get, I can be apart from a friend of mine. I have somebody I've not seen in like 10 years. This has happened to me more than once. See a guy, I haven't seen him in 10 years. We can be caught up completely in under a minute, and then we, right. then we can right. like have to switch to sports because right. there's no other way. We have nothing else to talk about.
Yeah, it's funny because my wife talks to my daughter on the phone. Is it the same thing you've just described? She talks to my son. It is definitely under a minute.
Yeah.
Just pick it right out of life, a good slice of life.
But I did in this book, I did make an honest effort in this book to find out what women think. In one respect, I read 50 Shades of Grey.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the essays in the book, which is the best selling book of modern times. Have you read it by any chance?
No, I haven't.
No, go ahead.
Well, my heart can't take stuff like that.
100 million books sold, yeah. and almost all to women.
Sure.
So I thought, well, I got to find out what's going on here. So I actually read 50 Shades of Grey to find out what women think. And you know what I determined? I have no idea. If I were to reveal the plot to you, you would be utterly baffled.
You didn't know that going in?
No, but I thought this would at least help a little. But yeah, it does. Are you familiar with the plot of the book?
Well, just very generally, yeah. I mean, certainly much has been said of it and much has been written about it. Yeah, I'm generally familiar with it.
Okay.
Why, is there something you would like to tell me about it?
Well, no. I mean, just that – I mean, and I should say, spoiler alert, anybody out there planning to read 50 Shades of Grey, be prepared because I'm going to tell you the plot. This young woman falls in love with this guy who is a 27-year-old hot billionaire. And that's fine. Okay, I get that. Why wouldn't a woman want a 27-year-old hot billionaire? Although she keeps claiming that she's not shallow, but she does tell you at least every other sentence how hot he is. So the thing is, he's got this thing. He wants to tie her up and hit her. That's what he wants to do. He's into S&M. And she doesn't really want that. So for 300 pages, he goes back and forth. Man, he's a hot billionaire and the sex is great, but he wants to tie me up and hit me. But he is a hot billionaire. On and on and on. Finally, at the end of whatever, 300 pages, she lets him tie her up to hit her. And
spoiler alert.
It hurts. she doesn't like it. So she breaks up with him, and that's the end of the book. That's the end of the book. That's the plot. So I'm like, asked my wife when it was over, I said, do you secretly want me to tie you up and hit you? And she goes, no. So we're left with four elements, 27, hot, billionaire, tie you up and hit you. Of the four, the only one I can do is tie you up and hit you. And then my wife does not want that. So I don't. I came out of this book with no new information.
There may be a fifth element, and that would be sequel. if you can capture the success of the first time around.
There were two more written,
yeah.
But I didn't read them because I assume they weren't any improvement on the first one.
Dave Barry is our guest. We're talking about his book, brand new book, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. And that's advice that he gives to his daughter, by the way.
Correct.
Just in case anyone is
And I'm thinking of moving that up to a little bit later.
Now that she's
14, yeah. I'm thinking 40 might be a little soon.
We'll continue our conversation with Dave Barry in just a moment. Love to get you into this discussion as well. Give us a call if you like at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, do so at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with Dave Barry. You know him well. He's written some 30 books. He was a columnist for the Miami Herald for about 20 years and won a Pulitzer Prize for doing that. Latest book is You Can Date Boys When You're 40. And by the way, Dave Barry is going to be at Maryville this evening for the Maryville Talks book series. That's going to be happening at 7 o'clock. We have more information about that on our website at STL on Air. I want to go right to the phones because Jerry and O'Fallon is picking up on our earlier conversation about Robert Benchley. So let's bring Jerry in. Go ahead, Jerry.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And I first have to preface this by saying that I am the father of three young women who are now past their teens. But, yes, it can be a bit trying. And
we feel your pain.
Yes, and also sometimes in there being Italian, you have a certain image that you're supposed to maintain about sternness with people they want to date. But anyway, we got through it, and everyone's doing it okay. I have to say a couple things. One thing, I have about 30 of your quotes. I collect quotes, and I use them often, and I do attribute them to you.
It's called plagiarism.
Well, no. It's Oscar Levant once said, I think that imitation is the sincerest form of plagiarism.
Yeah.
But I do credit you with that. But anyway,
well,
my favorite is, if you had to identify in one word the reason why the human race has not achieved and will never achieve its full potential, that word would be meetings. But now, I was a huge fan of Robert Benchley. I owe my cultural taste, I guess, to KPLR Television, which was a local station that played old movies, and became a fan of the Marx Brothers and learning more about them. Harpo Marx was a big was part of the Algonquin group on the East Coast, and I really became and still read Robert Benchley. In fact, I even like his When You Can See Him sometimes on TCM, the short films.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of interesting what happened to him. He wrote a thing called The Treasurer's Report, mm-hmm. which is an incredible
classic
piece of humor.
Yeah.
But it almost, in a way, destroyed him, because he was making, you know, newspaper guy money. And this he read that a couple of times at dinners, after dinners, and it was just a huge success. And some Broadway impresario who had one of those follies things decided to pay Robert Benchley every night to come out and read the Treasurer's Report. And he thought that was ridiculous, but they paid him an absurd amount of money. So he went and did it. Then he got involved in the movies, and he went out to L.A. and did a short of that, and then started doing other shorts. But the result was he was getting paid so much money to do that, he sort of stopped writing toward the end there. And he didn't like that about himself, but the money was really great, so he kept taking it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that money will do that to you sometimes.
Yeah.
not that I would know.
Would not affect us, though.
No. It certainly wouldn't. Jerry, you still there? Was there something else you wanted to add?
I was talking over Jerry.
All right. Well, maybe he'll call back if he has something more. What is your process for writing? I mean, you've got to be funny. I'm sure you feel that. We talked about the pressure. But what is the process daily?
It's very slow. I write every day. Well, not when I'm on a book tour. But when I'm home, I always have something due, always. And I'm a morning person. So, I start writing. And it's slow for me. It's always been painfully slow, and I'm always convinced that I'm no longer any good at it. And I think that's sort of a standard mode for a lot of writers to be in. But, you know, every now and then I'll get so desperate that I will print it out and take it across the room to my wife, who's a sports writer, sits on the other side of the room and say, just tell me it's not funny, okay? I can take it. I'm not funny anymore. I'm going to have to become an insurance salesperson or something, you know. And she always says, no, it's funny. And I think, I wonder if she's lying this time. But a lot of insecurity. But I'm a very, very slow writer. Because you can't, with humor, you can't kind of skip ahead. You can't outline it. You're like, what are you going to say in the outline? Funny thing here. Funny thing here. You actually have to produce a joke. And I find that slow.
I wonder if it's more difficult for a humorist to write than for a novelist to write, for instance. Because you do have to. And once you have a storyline for the novel, and you can work with that. Writer's block, I think, would be a problem for someone writing humor.
Yeah, there are days when you just don't feel funny. I have written some novels. I'm not going to hold myself up as an expert on it. But I find that when I'm writing fiction, the hardest part for me, and this is something I learned from my good friend Ridley Pearson, who lives here in St. Louis, is figuring out the whole plot before you start. You know, in other words, really figuring out how it's going to end before you start it. You know you're going to create a situation where people are going to get into some difficulty. That's fairly easy to do. Mm-hmm. Question is, how are you going to resolve that in a way that everybody finds plausible and satisfying? And your temptation is to just start writing. You really want to just start writing. At least mine is to just get going. But if you actually take the time, you know, and sometimes weeks to puzzle it all the way through, how is it going to end and why? Then I find writing novels is easier because you know where you're going. Mm-hmm. And also I don't feel as compelled to make every single sentence funny. When I'm writing a book like this one, I really do feel that, you know, obligation. This has to be funny. This line has to be funny. Could it be funnier? How could I punch this up? And if I use weasel instead of badger here, will it be mm-hmm. a funnier sounding sentence, you know, that kind of thing.
So you take it to your wife, a journalist, as your son. I'm surprised she even talks to you after
the way
you write about her in the book.
Hey, no, I'm just fairly honest about my wife. I do say in this book, there's an essay about a trip to Israel. We went to Israel. I'm not Jewish. My wife is Jewish. She's Cuban-Jewish. Mm-hmm. They call themselves Jubans. I always say they didn't come over on rafts. They parted the Caribbean. And she – She is a the Navy SEAL Team 6 of shoppers. This woman, wherever you put her, you know, drop her in the Amazon rainforest, she will find a gift shop and come out of there.
This will look great in the living room.
Exactly. Yeah. So I do mention that, but just, I don't really know that she can argue with me. You know, I have the credit card bills to prove that she does actually behave that way in, you know, travel situations.
That trip to Israel was interesting for a lot of reasons, and I love the way you started it with regard to just let's go to some place that's calm and peaceful and there's no danger.
Yeah, you never read the headline that says everything quiet in the Middle East.
Right.
Israel getting along real well with neighbors. That's a headline you never actually see. So we were a little apprehensive. And when we went on El Al, which is the Israeli airline, and there's a lot of security. I mean, a lot. And you know, you assume it's there for a reason. And when you get there, there are soldiers everywhere. The Israeli – the kids, really, teenagers are the Israeli army. And they are everywhere you go. You see young people with rifles, which they never put down. Even when they're eating, the rifle is on their lap. You know, and that sort of reminds you, this is a country that has been at war more than once and is ready, is always ready. They never let down. But once, you know, we've been there for a few days, you know, despite that, people are leading fairly normal lives. This is their existence. And it's, you know, it's a fascinating part of the world. Just fascinating.
There is an old joke. It goes something like, I'm so old that when I was born, the Dead Sea was just sick. And you write about the Dead Sea and give us a new look at that particular body of water.
The Dead Sea. Only there's like, there are things that only tourists do. And we did them. One of them was we went into the Dead Sea, which no other organism is as stupid as tourists. You know, fish, which are not considered the brightest animals on the world, they don't go in the Dead Sea. Nobody, and you get near it, and you know, there's sign after sign saying, "Do not immerse your face. Do not open your eyes. Do not swallow the water." If so basically it's saying this is toxic sludge. Stay away from it. Is basically what it's saying. But of course, you know, we're tourists, so we have to go in the Dead Sea and be photographed bobbing around, and we do. And then you like almost immediately discover that every orifice in your body is screaming out in pain. I mean, every orifice in your body.
Yeah, I get it.
Okay. So, and then you notice that the guide didn't go within 100 yards of the Dead Sea. You know, another one like that is camels. You go on a camel ride in the Negev Desert. The Bedouin have this camel concession where they have a train of like 20 camels tied together nose to tail. And, you know, you get out of your bus, the camels come over, they kneel down, they have saddles, and they put two tourists on each camel. And the Bedouin guide saying, do not scream when camel is getting up. Camel is getting up a little funny. And I'm thinking, well, how bad can it be? It's like, because it's a very terrifying thing when the camel. And my conclusion after riding for a half mile on a camel is, if this is how people are getting around here, no wonder this part of the world is so tense.
Well, you have another element there on that trip, and that is something that I would choose not to do, and that is rappelling.
Oh.
I mean, it's scary stuff.
Again, in the Negev Desert, you could sign up to go rappelling off this cliff. And I don't like heights, and I never would have ever done this, but my daughter said, can we do that? That's something, you know, how am I going to say, no, we can't because your father's terrified.
That's
that
14-year-old again, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I assumed it would be, you know, like in the United States, if you're going to rappel off of anything, if you can do anything, you're first of all, they're going to show you a video of safety video. They're going to make you sign 58 release forms and everything. And then there's going to be all equipment and everything. Here, it's just one guy standing on the edge of a cliff with a steel ring bolted into the cliff and some ropes. That's it. That was our guy. And you basically hold on to this rope. He puts you on a harness and you back off. This cliff, it's just completely – it's contrary to everything. And the rabbi of the temple that was at the bottom of the cliff, rabbi, and I had this fear that, you know, I was gonna poop on the rabbi coming down, which is probably a very serious violation of the Bible, the Old Testament.
It just shows you how smart rabbis can be, that they're waiting for you at the bottom.
No, he went down first. That was very courageous of him, I thought.
Absolutely. We'll talk more about specific elements of the book, but I want to get the listening audience back into this conversation. So let's start that process with Diane calling from St. Louis County. Diane, thanks for being with us. Go ahead. Diane, are you there?
Hello.
Yeah,
there's Diane.
There's
you.
Yes. Go ahead, Diane.
Does my memory serve correct? Were you a friend of Warren Zevon?
Yes, I was a good friend of Warren's. He played in the band, the Rock Bottom Remainders. For years, he joined us. What a great guy, and what a loss that was.
Oh, I know. Still listen to his music.
Yeah.
One of a kind.
Yeah, and I can hear it in your voice. The people, Warren was not the most popular musician. You know, he never had the numbers, but man, the people who love Warren really, really love Warren. So he was a genius, that guy.
He was.
Diane, thanks for checking in. Anything else you would like to say to Dave Barry? Apparently not. I have an email here from Vivian. She says, I laugh out loud at Dave Barry's two true-to-life comments on the joy and ridiculousness of modern life, but there's a serious piece that I've passed along at times, too, written after his father's death, A Million Words, a beautiful essay on saying goodbye and letting go, and I wanted to thank him for it.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Yeah, when my dad died, I was fortunate enough to see him when, and you know he was going and I knew that you don't always get this opportunity. I knew it was the last time I was going to talk to my father, and I was looking for something. I don't know what I was looking for, something, you know, for him to say something meaningful. But he was struggling. I mean, he was in a difficult state physically, and his last words to me, you know, were basically, you know, do you think I could get some ice, you know? Mm-hmm. And I walked out and I'm crying and I think, you know, he doesn't owe me, you know, I have a whole lifetime of words. That's where the title came from, a million words with my dad. So anyway, thank you for remembering that. That was a long time ago.
You spend some time thinking about mortality, your own mortality in your book.
I do. I have an essay on death.
Exactly.
On aging and death. Yeah. Starting with the beginning of the aging process, which I say it's when you're 50 and it's when you get that letter from ARP. ARP is, of course, the last sound you make before you die.
American Association of Retired Persons, for those who haven't reached 50 yet.
Yeah, you get that. But then, yeah, I talk about – we're like – I'm a baby boomer, and you know how we are. We have to talk about ourselves, and we have to act as though everything we're doing nobody's ever done before. We did it with childbirth. No, you know, nobody ever had gave birth to children until the baby boomers did.
That's
and
right.
We invented a whole new way of doing it and everything. And we're going to do it with death. We're going to – we're going to be the first generation ever to die. We're going to be talking about it a lot. So, yeah, I have an essay on that and things I do and don't like, mostly things I don't like about it. And I have a program for my funeral in there.
I know you do. As a matter of fact, I'm opening the book now because I've marked off this page. In promoting this program, I mentioned something about William Shatner. You want William Shatner to do the eulogy.
If he's available, I want him to do the eulogy.
Okay.
I don't care what he says.
Well, let me just read what it says here. Okay. It's very funny. I would like my eulogy to be given by a close friend or, if he is available, William Shatner. I will not presume to dictate the contents of the eulogy. My only requests are that one be done entirely in a fake Scottish accent. Two, have a charades portion. Three, feature at some point the word poontang.
Yeah, other than that, he's free to say whatever he wants.
I just don't know how you get there. I mean, there again, I've read this several times, and I'm chuckling. I don't know how you get there with this stuff that's just over the top, off the wall, where it comes from.
Well, you're just sitting around. You know, you have to picture me. I'm sitting around in my T-shirt and shorts in Miami, and all around me are people going to work, you know, just real serious people with jobs and everything. And I'm sitting there thinking, I got to think of a joke here or I'll have to go to work too. I don't want that to happen.
God forbid.
Yeah.
So
it's a powerful incentive.
Sitting around by yourself occasionally when your wife is in the room and she is off to work, no doubt.
Yeah.
Another phone call here. Brian in Wentzville. Go ahead. You're on the air with Dave Barry.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing great. I was just wanting to call and let you know that we've loved your books. The kids really like the Peter and the Starcatcher ones.
Oh, great.
And they've read them, you know, since they first came out. And I remember reading you in the newspaper, I think. I'm 40-something now, back when I was probably 10. And you had a story about driving an old Camaro, and you would fix it by the warning light would come on. You'd use a piece of stick.
Yeah, I did. I put a piece of black tape over the... And a lot of other car problems you can solve by turning up the radio also.
I remember that vividly, and just wanting to let you know we really enjoy your books. I really enjoyed your last one, about the guy getting married.
Oh, Insane City, the novel.
Yes, that was wonderful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I was fond of that myself, that book.
Brian,
well, I appreciate what you do.
Brian, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Maureen now. She's called from Baden.
Hi,
Go ahead, Maureen.
Hey, much like everybody else, I laugh out loud at your books.
Thank you.
And Money Secrets, I've probably read 5 times.
Yeah, but you didn't follow any of the advice in there, did you?
No.
Okay, good.
Except sale of kidneys. That is my plan for retirement. But I have a question for you. During that whole Bush-Gore election, you did so many funny things about the state of Florida and its crazy residents. I'm wondering if you might be able to give us Midwesterners an update on, you know, any Sunshine State politics or anything, like if Jeb Bush is planning to run for president.
I think he is. Well, it's Florida is just as weird as ever. Our motto should be Florida. You can't spell it without duh. But we had a thing last year. I don't know if you heard about it out here, called the Python Challenge, which is it's still one of the most absurd things. We have these Burmese pythons that have infested Miami and the Everglades. Yeah. Which are these giant snakes. It shouldn't be there. They should be in Burma, wherever that is. But people, you know, brought them in as pets. Why you would want to have a giant carnivorous snake as a pet, I don't know. But eventually they ran out of crack, these people, so they let them go. So we had the Florida State Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission had this thing last year called the Python Challenge, where they invited anybody who wanted to come to Florida to kill our pythons. And I won't go into all the details, but it was pretty funny. And they ended up with 1,600 people came. And they had a whole month now, and there are literally hundreds of thousands of pythons out there in the Everglades. At the end of a month, total number of pythons killed, 68. In other words, the pythons won the Python Challenge. We didn't do it.
Well, you'd like to solve that problem.
And all of those pythons can vote, by the way. That's for the record. And they also all have valid Florida driver's licenses.
Yeah, in 2000, yeah. Some of them probably did,
yeah.
Right? Pythons, as I understand it, I think they can grow to be 20, 25
yeah,
feet long.
Every now and then.
And swallow a goat.
Yes. We have. There's a picture, a famous picture ran on the front page of the Herald of a python that had died eating an alligator, and the alligator was like 8 feet long. I mean, it's just big. These are huge snakes. And every few weeks, they catch another one somewhere in, you know, like somebody's neighborhood. It's gigantic. I mean, not little snakes.
Well, at the rate they're going, I guess in another 2,000 years, they'll have them all, perhaps. Dave Barry is our guest. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Again, our lines are open. Give us a call to 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org or send us a tweet at STL on air. His book is You Can Date Boys When You're 40. Back with Dave Barry in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation with author Dave Barry, humorist Dave Barry. We'll continue that conversation in a moment, but first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Polls are open in Illinois as voters cast ballots in the state's primary election. The most prominent race on the ballot is the Republican campaign for governor. Businessman Bruce Rauner, state treasurer Dan Rutherford, and state senators Bill Brady and Kirk Dillard are vying for the party's nomination to continue on to the general election in November. And supporters of raising the federal minimum wage delivered petitions to Senator Roy Blunt's office in Clayton today. They want Congress to boost the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, saying it will help the economy. The wage is currently $7.25 an hour. The Senate may vote on a minimum wage increase next month. You can hear more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with humorist Dave Barry. Dave, is there any subject that is off limits to you, taboo, things you won't touch?
Yeah, there are many. You know, I've never written any humor about the Holocaust, or I never would write about child abuse or rape or anything like that. There are things that you can kind of write around. You know, like drug abuse is not funny, but government policies toward drugs and the war on drugs can be funny. So, you know, it's just a question of, I think, common sense for the most part. There are humorists who do humor about all those things. Sure. I'm just not one of them. Because I came from a newspaper background where there really were, you know, pretty clear limits. I pushed them, but I still think of myself as mainly kind of family-oriented rather than just shock.
Do you ever miss that, the day-to-day world of that kind of journalism where you could take an issue of the day and deal with it in your own way?
Yes and no. Every now and then I do. I get a fix. Like every 4 years I go to the conventions and I write daily from the conventions. Mm-hmm. You could argue that's not really news. It's theater, but mm-hmm. I still enjoy writing about it. But for the most part, no. Now, if you think about it, if something happens in the news now, before I could get a column out in the paper, there would be 1,000 tweets about it. And often very funny. There are some really, very talented people who do nothing pretty much all day but think of jokes for Twitter. Jon Stewart would have talked about it all. All the nighttime hosts would have had jokes about it. Letterman and all those folks, written by really good gag writers. And so by the next day, it'd be picked over pretty thoroughly. So I tend to go toward more essays and kind of more, I guess, random humor.
I wonder how you might handle what's going on now with regard to this Malaysian plane.
Well, I actually tweeted something about it this morning, and I wondered if it was, I said, I think maybe it's in my garage. There's a lot of stuff in there, And even then I felt a little uncomfortable. I said, is it okay to make it? But it's gotten to the point where now, it kind of crosses over to you're not really, I don't think, making a joke about the possible death of all these people. You're really talking about, isn't it weird that this happened? And everyone's talking about it. Everyone wonders where it is. And somewhere in that nexus, humor arises. It's kind of like there's been a lot of humor about the war on terror, not really about the World Trade Centers coming down, but about what happened as a result of that. Things that make people nervous and tense, those things tend to become jokes at some point, which is how I think one way people deal with them.
I saw something in the paper this morning indicating that Courtney Love believes she has found the plane. She's seen some picture or some satellite photograph.
I knew that if anybody was going to find that, it would be Courtney Love. She's did she really? Courtney Love found it? Well, why didn't we ask Courtney Love sooner then? Doggone it.
Well, now, any chance
that maybe Justin Bieber also knows,
I've resisted bringing up Justin Bieber's name on this program because everything I've read about you in this book starts with, just as the book does, with taking your daughter to the Justin Bieber concert. No, okay, you brought it up.
No, I didn't mean it in that way. Yes, I did. I will just say, I took my daughter to the Justin Bieber concert. It was an act of love on my part. It was also the loudest thing I've ever – and I have been in a hurricane. I had a hurricane go over my house, Hurricane Andrew, 1992. That was the loudest thing I ever heard until I got to a Justin Bieber concert. Any one of the teenage girls there by herself.
There were teenage girls there?
Quite a few. There were 8 dads. And the thing is, the way they express joy – I'm assuming it was joy. They love Justin Bieber. There he was. It's the same sound that you would make if your feet were being gnawed off by weasels. It's like, oh, I love you.
Well, and your daughter certainly was among them.
She was, but she got – that's the thing. She doesn't love him anymore. Now she thinks he's an idiot. Now she loves One Direction, which is a little scarier because there's 5 of them.
Oh, well, you took her to the Bieber concert before he was arrested.
When she was 13, she was a younger woman then. Now she's older and wiser. She's 14, and she doesn't want Justin Bieber anymore.
Okay, well, I was going to resist that.
We dealt with it. It's out of the way.
It is out of the way. Let's go back to the callers who will get some other things into this conversation. Mike in Mount Olive, go ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air with Dave Barry.
Hey, Dave. I just wanted to call quickly because I've left Mount Olive and I'm driving to St. Louis and I got my phone up to my ear and I just had the cop and he's coming after me.
Uh-oh.
And I can't believe this is happening. That's why I know. Listen.
Do you want me to talk to him? It's legal to talk to an author while you're driving.
Good.
In the state of Missouri.
I'm on the phone. I'm going to slow down. I was slowing down. But here's what I called. I couldn't believe I turned you on. We lived in Syracuse, New York. And when the kids were little, we would get the newspaper, Sunday newspaper open, and we would read Dave Barry out loud to the kids, and then they would read it themselves. Now,
now they're all in prison, right?
Oh, my gosh. Listen to this. So my daughter grows up. After 9/11, she says, I'm going to join the Army. I got to do something. She joins the Army, and they said, what do you want to do? And she says, well, I would like to write. So they made her a journalist. So she goes to Iraq, and she did 2 tours there, and sure enough, she was a journalist. And she had a blog. on the side, and it was called Ben Murphy, all one word. It was hilarious, absolutely hilarious, and it was your voice. It was your voice. And now the cop is behind me.
So, in other words, the Army trained your daughter to write humor on a blog.
And, you know, she did the two tours. She came back. The last tour was the post-traumatic stress really got through her when she came back home. And what ultimately happened was she's using humorous writing to get herself through the difficulties of returning back home.
Oh, that's good. My theory is that that's why we have humor is, you know, it's not random. It's because we need it, you know.
Yeah, and she's living proof of it. She's not taking any of the drugs that the VA tells her. She's using humor, and she's using her writing.
Could you send me the drugs if she's not taking
them? Well, it looks like I'm getting pulled over.
Oh, man, I'm sorry.
Hey,
good luck with that.
Keep the phone line open here. If we can be of any help, we'll certainly try to be.
I will, Dave. I will.
All right. Well, let's keep that line open and see
poor
what
guy.
Happens.
I feel bad for him.
We'll try another call while we're waiting to see what happens to Mike. Dave in O'Fallon, Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Barry.
Hello.
Love your books.
Oh, thank you.
And have enjoyed them. We have even used them, the audio books in the cars when we make the long trips. My question is, I'd like to know how many hours you had to spend in a men's room to come up with the analysis journal usage in your Dave Barry's Guide to Men.
Oh, yeah, I have a chart in the Complete Guide to Guys where it explains the etiquette for the benefit of women that's, you know, who think that men go through no stress, that the stress involved in choosing the right urinal when you come into a men's room, it's an instantaneous critical calculation that men have to make. There always has to be a buffer urinal. It's very difficult to go mm-hmm. through. I would say the total amount of research I did on that, 3 to 4 minutes, which for me is a lot.
Why is it when we're out in a public place with a couple of couples that when one woman goes up to go to the ladies' room, another one will always join her? But when a man gets up, he always goes alone.
That's a good example of what we were talking about earlier, how much more social women are than men. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really don't really – I mean, I don't like it when guys talk in the bathroom, you know, yeah. the guys who strike up a conversation. You know, I don't want that. You know,
straight ahead.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking to me? No.
There's something else I wanted to mention here, and this is actually the first thing I saw when I picked up your book, You Can Date Boys When You're 40. It's another one of these things that, in my mind, just comes straight out of left field. Where did it come from? And that is and on how to dress and wearing capri pants.
Capri pants, yeah. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just every few months, the men's fashion industry, which is always trying to trick men into doing things, declares that capri pants are in for men. I don't know how many times I've seen that declared in the New York Times. And they always show pictures of guys wearing capri pants. Of course, they're professional models. They don't look happy about it either anyway. No. And maybe like two bozos in New York City actually go buy capri pants. The rest of us don't do it, you know. And so I'm advising against that. And people say, well, there are countries where men do wear capri pants. And I say, yeah, but none of those countries has ever won a war.
That's the line that just absolutely cracked me up. I was going to read it, but you beat me to it. This is not a matter of taste or style. It's a matter of scientific fact. A man who puts on capri pants, no matter how suave and attractive he is, otherwise immediately transforms himself into a Category 5. You can say the word.
Douche.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the star catcher thing.
Yeah. And
this is, we'll give, hopefully, Ridley, you say he's in California.
Ridley is out of town right now, but so this is his town.
Yeah, but he's not listening. But how did all this come about? How did you two get together on this?
Well, we got together because we're in the band together, and we were friends. And he was reading the original Peter Pan by J.M. Barrie to his daughter Paige. This is back when she was 6 years old, so it would be about 10 years ago, a little more. And Paige asked him, how did Peter Pan meet Captain Hook in the first place? Because when you think about it, this is all sort of presented as this is the situation. There's an island, and this boy can fly, and he has a little fairy friend, and there's, you know, it's all. But no, there's no explanation. So Ridley, the band happened to be playing at the Miami Book Fair. Ridley was staying at my house. And he said, Paige asked me this question while I was reading Peter Pan to her, and I thought it would be kind of cool to write a book answering the question, where did Peter Pan come from? And I said, yeah, that's kind of a neat idea. I never thought of that. And he goes, well, do you want to do it with me? And I said, yeah. Neither one of us had ever written anything for children. And we really didn't have any idea what kind of book it would be. Or we didn't have an idea for it yet. But it just seemed like a good idea. And we ended up writing this series of books. They're all about 500 pages. They're big books. Mm-hmm. Lots of characters, lots of stuff. Who knew? And then it ended up being a Broadway play, and now it's touring the country.
It was here in St. Louis just a couple of weeks ago. And it won several Tony Awards.
It won five Tony Awards on Broadway. Yeah, so it was a terrific play. Rick Ellis, who wrote Jersey Boys, adapted it for the stage. And it's an amazing thing. I can say this without being immodest, because it really is not the bare bones of the plot are what we wrote, but it's the characters and so on. But the play is completely different in imagination, reimagining of what we did, and it's really funny. It's incredibly clever. A lot of wordplay.
Any input at all from either of you into the final product?
When they were first workshopping it out in La Jolla, California. Ridley and I went out and watched some of the early versions of it, and we had some thoughts, and we gave them to Rick, and he took some and didn't take some, but we didn't really presume to tell Rick Ellis, the guy who wrote Jersey Boys, how to write a play, and it was good that we didn't, he did a fantastic job.
Sometimes it's hard for authors to let go. I mean, many of them who have written books that have been turned into movies, for instance, lose all control, and in fact, often are very disappointed.
Yeah, I've had that happen, and it's very weird. The best advice I got about that was from Jeff Arch, who wrote Sleepless in Seattle. Mm-hmm. He wrote the screenplay. There was no book. And he said, if you sell a book to somebody to make a movie, it's the same as if you'd sold your house. You can't come back later and say, I don't like what you did with the curtains. It's not your house anymore. You sold it to them. So that's good advice. You got to let it go. And, sometimes it comes out better, sometimes it comes out worse. They definitely change it. That's the one thing I've learned. They don't ever leave it alone.
And, of course, he had one of the best scenes ever in movie in Sleepless in Seattle, and that is I'll Have What She's Having. Yeah.
Well, that was When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, and Harry Met Sally. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. That so was a great scene.
Yeah, it was a great
different
scene.
Same. I think it was the same director. I think it was Nora Ephron, but...
Nora Ephron, of course. Well, my mistake. It's not the first of the day, and it certainly won't be the last. Just a couple of minutes left. I have to ask about the Rock Bottom Remainders. People know all about it, but I'm under the impression, we talked about this off the air, that Rock Bottom Remainders may be on its way out, or?
Well, we played for 20 years, and our founder, Kathy Goldmark, great lady, died. And we kind of thought maybe we would end it. We had this big concert. It was sort of a tribute to her. But we wrote a book, an e-book, called Hard Listening, which is our genre of music. Everybody contributed essays, including even Stephen King. And we wanted to promote that last fall at the Miami Book Fair. So we got together one last time. And as Mitch Albom said, we're a terrible band. We never could start songs together. We never end songs together. We can't even break up together. So the band is kind of in limbo, but we're all still friends. That's the best part.
But that's quite a bunch of big literary names, if you will. How did that all come together? I mean, bringing you all together in one place.
Kathy Goldmark, who is then a literary escort in San Francisco, this is the person who picks you up at the airport and takes you to all your media like this, events like this one. Kathy was also in the music scene in San Francisco, and over the years she had driven around many authors who were into music or had played in bands, like I had played in a band when I was in college. So she had this idea in 1992 to have a benefit concert for – it was some First Amendment cause. And she just sent faxes – this is before email – to everybody she knew that said, if you want to be in this band, come to L.A. and we'll practice for a few days and then we'll play. And whoever said yes became the Remainders, including Stephen King, Amy Tan, a bunch of really good authors. It turns out we were not good at music, but we had the best time. We didn't want to stop. As Amy said, I would do this to kill the whales.
Amy, that was on the program a couple of months ago and surprised a lot of people, because she plays a dominatrix in all of this.
Nobody recognizes Amy. Everybody thinks she's this, intellectual, good little girl. No. She's a wild woman, Amy Tan.
How much money have you raised for charity, do you think?
A couple million. No, we have. We've raised a lot of money. Some people, we think we could get more money if they would pay us not to play, maybe. It's like, you know, we're going to come and do a concert unless you pay us.
Well, Dave Barry, our time is up. I'm so appreciative of your being here, and I know the folks are going to really enjoy you at Maryville University tonight at 7 o'clock. Information on that particular event is on our website at stopublicradio.org. Best of success with book. You can date boys when you're 40, and we'll look forward to the next one. They're always great.
Thank you, and I'm really sorry to that guy who got a ticket.
Well, I hope he did.
That's a first for me.
Maybe he could talk his way out of it. I hope so. Tomorrow in St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about what makes a good school district, the challenges, opportunities, and specifically ways to address chronic absenteeism. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stopublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.